I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we continue our discussion of the trial of Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my resplendent co-host, Alice.
Wow, Brett, what a descriptor. Thank you.
Yeah, that was Harriet. Harriet coming through. Thank you, Harriet.
Harriet, she's been with us through the beginning.
She really has. I think she was our first fan.
I think we actually, between the two of us, we would text about her all the time because we're like, we have a fan. It's Harriet.
I know. It was amazing. It was amazing.
We love Harriet. Harriet.
Harriet's awesome. So if my voice sounds a little scratchy, I don't know. I've got the COVID vaccine, so I'm supposed to never be sick again, right? But instead, I feel awful.
Are you sick? But
yeah, I don't know what it is.
Is it allergies? Because allergies is bad
I think
right
so.
Now.
I think it's allergies.
I hope
really,
it's just allergies.
Really hitting me hard.
Oh,
so,
I'm sorry.
If you're listening out there, don't be annoyed by my scratchy voice. I'm sorry. And if I cough, I'll try and cut it out in the editing process. But
I'm pretty sure the fan club of Brett always will love your voice, no matter what it sounds like. So, ladies, this one's for you.
I'm kind of afraid. I'm afraid that they're gonna turn on me, you know? Didn't lose them in the Taylor Swift episode, but I'm going to lose them now. I guess we'll see.
That will be another show when we talk about the Taylor Swift episode.
The Taylor Swift episode.
It was a joke, guys.
It was
guys.
Quite an experience. It was a joke. In case you missed it, it was a joke. Anyway. Well, Alice, we're back here today talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, the death of George Floyd, and the police officer who is most responsible for that, however responsible you think he is. The man who was seen by millions of people around the world, billions of people possibly, with his knees on George Floyd for over 9 minutes until George Floyd passed away. And he is being tried, even as we speak, in a Minnesota courtroom. Yesterday, we talked about some of the underlying decisions the prosecution had to make, things like charging decisions, the different kinds of charges that he faces. And we also dove into the opening statements for the prosecution to lay out for you the theory that they have of the case. And then we talked about the defense opening statement and the story that the defense is going to try and tell in this trial. But at the end of the day, the lawyers can talk and talk, but what really matters are the witnesses. Trials are entirely about witnesses, even when you think about things like videos or fingerprints or DNA, stuff like that. All of that comes in through witness testimony. And today, we're going to start talking about witness testimony. And one thing that's really interesting about this case, and I'm interested to hear what Alice thinks about this, is the choice of who you're going to put on first. Who was going to be the first witness for the prosecution? And I was thinking about, I have this trial that may or may not be coming up, and I was sort of thinking over the weekend, like, who would be my first witness in that case? Like, how would I want to start it? And there's a lot of different ways to do it. And I think it's interesting that in this case, the prosecution started with a 911 operator.
Right, Brett. It's really interesting because, as you mentioned, evidence comes in through witnesses. It is not from the attorneys. The attorneys make arguments based on the evidence, but the evidence can only come in through witnesses. And likely, no one witness will have all of the evidence necessary for your case. And so, though your opening statement laid out your whole story, your first witness is very important because this is the first time they're hearing from someone from the prosecution in this case. And this first person sets the tone for what the story will sound like, but this first person likely will not have the full story that's necessary for the prosecution. So the 911 operator, the first witness the prosecution called was Jenna Lee Scurry, a 911 operator. The prosecution previewed her testimony in their opening, saying, "You'll learn that what she saw was so unusual and for her so disturbing that she did something she had never done in her career. She called the police on the police." And that really was her testimony. Scurry was watching video of the arrest via a police camera. Disturbed by what she was seeing, she called police. She said that Chauvin was kneeling on Floyd's neck for so long, she thought the screen had frozen. Now, on cross-examination, remember, every witness that's put on the stand is subject to cross-examination by the opposing counsel, in this case, the defense. The defense elicited testimony from Scurry that she was not familiar with the use of force requirements of the police department and that she had witnessed the officers struggling with Floyd.
Yeah, so there's a couple interesting things about this, and it also sort of sets the tone for the way the prosecution is going to proceed in this trial. As we said yesterday, the police are very much aligning themselves with the prosecution. So the way the prosecution approaches this is they sort of ping-pong back and forth. They talk to a prosecution witness who is a person in law enforcement, for instance, and then they'll ping-pong over to just a bystander who was there or a doctor who was involved. And you're going to see this throughout the first week of trial. And we're in the second week right now. And I can tell you they're doing it in the second week as well. And this person is interesting because this is not some bystander on the side of the street. Now, you may recall the defense in their opening statement tried to say that the use of force it's an unpleasant thing, but it has to happen sometimes. And this was perfectly in keeping with the department policies. And what does the prosecution do? They don't start with a bystander who doesn't know anything about policing, who's just completely unfamiliar with it. They start with a 911 operator. Now, yeah, she doesn't know the use of force requirements of the police department. And the defense does as good a job as it can of pointing that out, but she certainly knows policing and she's seen police officers before, and she's seen them engaged with defendants or with subjects and suspects before, and she is so disturbed by what she's saying that she feels the need to do something, to reach out to the police. And you guys know this. In any circumstance where you're in an organization, whenever you go sort of outside the chain of command to complain about one of your coworkers, even in an innocuous situation, it's stressful and it's not something you necessarily want to do. This is a pretty big deal. You can imagine that in doing this, she's kind of taking a chance. If she calls her supervisor or the police or whatnot, and they're like, "What are you doing? This was perfectly reasonable," that could be a problem for her at work. But she's so moved by what she's seeing that she feels compelled to do that.
You're right, Brett. I mean, this is a witness that is in line with the theory that the dichotomy that the prosecution has already set up in their statement of, like you said, aligning themselves with the police. And so I thought this was absolutely in line. And what you want to do with your witnesses is to kind of harken back to your opening statement so that, again, that framework is already in mind for the jurors as they hear from these witnesses. So it's not a standalone witness. So this is perfectly in line with what the prosecution has set up their case to be.
So the prosecution is going to call a lot of witnesses in this case. We're not going to talk about all of them. Some of them are just foundational witnesses for things like video. So for instance, this 911 operator was watching video from a police camera. I believe after her, they call a witness just to introduce that. Like we said earlier, all evidence comes in through a witness. So you have to call some boring witness who's like, "I run the police camera. Yes, this is the same video." And they authenticate it, and then it's introduced into evidence, and everybody can consider it. So we're not going to go through all that kind of stuff. The next really sort of substantive witness, so we start with a police witness. We start with a 911 operator. Then we call somebody who was on the scene. What is so interesting about this gentleman, he was on the scene, his name was Donald Wynn Williams, and he just so happens to be a man with experience in martial arts and someone who's trained in the use of chokeholds. It's really interesting because normally you would have to call an expert for this kind of witness. You'd have to have an expert come in and say they've reviewed the video, they've reviewed the documentation, and in their expertise, this is what they think. Well, this guy's a lay witness. He's not an expert witness, but he just so happens to be someone whose opinion on this stuff is a little bit more forceful and informative for the jury than sort of your average guy on the street. And he was present on the scene the day that George Floyd died. And he's able to give context to the video that we've seen so many times and talk about things that you might not necessarily recognize. Like he says, you can see his foot, talking about Chauvin. His toe is pointing down, and that's the pressure to push more down between his knee, George's head, and the concrete and cut off circulation. So he's able to talk about this more than just in a, yeah, I saw him on the ground and the guy was kneeling on him. It's more than that. He's able to point to specific things that Chauvin's doing that makes this even worse than maybe what you've heard before. So Williams was a great witness. He had been fishing that day. He actually compared what he was seeing to a fish out of water. He said, he was going through distress because of the knee. He vocalized it, that I can't breathe. I need to get up, and I'm sorry. And his eyes slowly rolled to the back of his head. And this, once again, the defense has told you what they're going to say. The defense is going to say this was perfectly reasonable. This was a perfectly reasonable use of force. This was a dangerous situation that was escalating. And it was escalating around the officers, and they had to do this. And what the prosecution's doing already is establishing that this reasonableness test, which is an objective test, reasonableness is, it's like the foundation of so many things in the law, but it's so confusing because it's not what might be reasonable to you or me. It's an objective measure. So you have to think of sort of the ideal policeman and what would be objectively reasonable to the ideal policeman in whatever situation they're in. And you already have the 911 operator who's kind of like a policeman who doesn't think it's reasonable. And then we turn to a bystander on the street. She was watching it on television. He was watching it up close and personal. And he just so happens to be somebody who understands this kind of stuff at a deeper level. And he doesn't think what's going on is reasonable. And he can recognize, even with his limited training, that George Floyd is in extreme distress. At some point, Williams calls 911. And this is sort of a repeating theme of the prosecution, is all the people who are calling 911 on the police, including the 911 operator herself. When asked why, he said, I believe I witnessed a murder. I felt the need to call the police on the police. The prosecutor asked, there were police there, right? Why didn't you just talk to them about it? And Williams said, we just didn't have no connection. I spoke to them, but not on a connection of a human being relationship.
Brett, you mentioned earlier that Williams is a great witness, and I want to explain that a little bit more. That's not necessarily just based on what he's saying, but when you put a witness on the stand, your goal as the attorney is to blend into the background because you don't want to tell the story. The attorney has already told the story. That was the opening statement. It is more effective for a jury to hear the story, not from the attorney's mouth, but from the witness's mouth. And while you can tell that Williams is a compelling storyteller, that is not always what you get. You don't always get good storytellers on the stand. This is from our own experience in putting up witnesses. You could have someone with the perfect background, with martial arts training, who was there, an eyewitness, and able to assess the situation based on their expert training, but they just can't put into words what they think. Here you have all of those things in terms of qualifications that lend credence to his testimony and the ability to verbalize in a way that connects with the people what he is seeing. The analogy to the fish, for example, is a powerful image. And again, like we've said, you prep your witnesses ahead of time. And I'm sure the prosecution spent a lot of time prepping their witnesses that they plan to call because you want to be prepared and know what they're going to say. But it's harder than you may think to get your witness to be a good storyteller. And prepping, by the way, doesn't mean you give your witness a script and they memorize it. Jurors can see past that. They can see past a memorized script from a witness. They want to hear, kind of like Williams is saying right here, they want to connect with that person on a human level and know that they're just talking to someone about their experience rather than hearing someone recite or regurgitate a script.
Yeah, an overprepped witness is as bad as an underprepped witness because they don't come off as genuine. They come off as scripted. And Williams does not come off as scripted. There's a reason they put him so early. They're really trying to front load this case. And you'll see that as we go on because the problems with the prosecution's case start to show up later on in this. These first few days, they are just crushing it. And the defense is completely on its back foot. And there are times where the defense would have been better off just not asking questions. And just a testament to how good Williams is, on cross-examination, the defense is trying to undercut his testimony essentially by almost a bias argument that this all comes from anger, that he was getting more and more angry on the scene, and that he was caught on video yelling at the police officers, and he called them bums at some point. And when asked if his growing criticism of the officers could be characterized as him growing more and more angry, he responded, "They grew more and more pleading for life," which is just, you know, it's a great rejoinder to this. It's sort of like, yeah, I was getting more agitated. This guy was dying. And he does a really good job of very early on establishing this emotional connection with the jury and starting to build this emotion about the injustice of what happened here. And I think this is as good a time as any to talk about this. Trials are not scientific endeavors. We talk about the rules of evidence. We talk about, you know, the balance of this against that and justice holds scales and all this stuff. And there's almost this feeling that you've got, you know, reasonable doubt on one side and you're stacking evidence on the other side and eventually the scale tips and you win. But at the end of the day, trials are also about emotion. They really are. If they are controlled by emotion or decided by emotion, that's a problem. But there's nothing wrong in our system with having emotion and connecting on a human level with the jury and sort of appealing to the jury's passions. Because once again, this is about justice. This is not, do you owe $10,000 because you didn't like the way your debt came out and you're suing the contractor. I mean, there's something much more sort of deep and fundamental here than that. And you're going to really see that in the beginning of this, where the prosecution is really doing a good job of building that sort of emotional connection and telling the jury, this is a huge injustice perpetrated by the defendant and you need to do something about it.
Right. And continuing with the prosecution's witnesses, they then call Darnella Frazier. We've talked a lot about this viral video that's been seen by millions, maybe billions of people around the world of George Floyd. Well, Darnella Frazier is the one who recorded this video of the incident. Now, she was only 17 at the time of the incident, and she testified that she began recording because Floyd was terrified and begging for his life. She broke down at times on the stand and was very emotional. And again, we were talking about how there is the human connection. And you might think that witnesses can be prepped to cry, but that's really hard because crying is, most of us are not actors and we can't just cry on command. And, you know, Brett, I think you and I both have had witnesses who've broken down on the stand before, and it is emotional, not only for the person on the stand, but for everyone in the courtroom, because you recognize something very vulnerable is happening. And that happened here. Now, On cross, the defense elicited testimony about the violence in the area and about the crowd that had gathered around the officers during their encounter with George Floyd. The defense's final question would actually prove to be a blunder with Ms. Frazier. When the defense asked if taking the video had changed her life, Frazier responded, quote, "It has." Now, presumably, the defense was trying to make some point about how she had benefited from being the one to record the encounter, whatever that may be, you know, having clicks on social media or what have you. Now, the prosecution does something effective here. They redirect. Redirect just means after you've been crossed, the person who initially did the direct questioning gets to stand up and do something called redirect, to only ask questions about points that were brought up on cross-examination. Essentially, it's a rebuttal. So the prosecution stands up and asks a simple question. How has it changed your life? Darnella responded, "It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting and not saving his life. But it's like, it's not what I should have done. It's what he," talking about Chauvin, "should have done." The young woman, who is Black, testified that when she saw Floyd, she thought of her father, her uncles, and her brothers, and how it could be any of them.
Now, there's no way any of this would have come in on direct, right? Like, there's no way you could get all this in your direct examination of this witness. But the defense, you know, swings the door wide open on this. By asking that question about it changing her life, they have opened the door for the prosecution to ask all these personal questions of her that really, in a lot of ways, don't have anything to do with whether or not Derek Chauvin acted reasonably when he was engaged in this encounter with Mr. Floyd. But that's some powerful testimony right there.
It's incredibly powerful. And just to explain it a bit further, the reason this redirect testimony never would have come in on direct is her comments about how Floyd could have been her family members. That has nothing to do with Floyd himself or the charges brought against Chauvin. Evidence is viewed through a lens of the specific charges for a specific defendant, and that's all typically that can come in. This, as you can see, is extraneous from Floyd or Chauvin. But like you said, it's a double-edged sword for the defense, and here when they've swung it open of how has it changed her life, the prosecution is allowed to follow up on that, and that's exactly what they did. The prosecution, and we've seen this from less experienced attorneys, if they didn't ask that question, they could have left this all out, right? You have to know to ask that next question. And I am not sure that the prosecution knew what her answer was. They also took a bit of a risk in asking that follow-up question.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure they spent a lot of time with her. They knew she wasn't going to say, or presumably knew she wasn't going to say, "Oh, it's great, I'm famous now, and everybody knows who I am, and they pay for my dinners and stuff." But yeah, I bet they did not know what she was going to say.
And that's a really good point, Brett. They did probably spend a lot of time with her, and while the direct examination of her was scripted in the sense that the prosecution had an outline and knew where they were going with leading her through her testimony, redirect is much more on the fly because you can only respond to what the opposing counsel said, and you don't know ahead of time what opposing counsel is saying. So redirect and rebuttal closing, for example, are two things where you have to really listen and question the witness on your feet, and that's what happened here.
And just to drill down a little bit more, probably on what the defense is doing, all questions have to be relevant. You know, there has to be some connection to the case, like Alice was saying. And questions that go to witness credibility and bias and that sort of things are always relevant. So presumably the defense is trying to undermine her credibility to the jury by asking this question. And the prosecution is allowed to rebuild her. You know, if her credibility is damaged, they can come in and work to restore credibility for her to me, I think this was a big mistake on the defense's part, because I don't know. Who cares? Who cares how it's changed her life? I mean, she took the video. The video speaks for itself. I think you just let their, you let her testify, you let her testify about the video. Maybe you do this about the fact it's a dangerous area and the crowd is growing angry, because that plays into your main theme that the police would have felt their lives were in danger or whatnot. But going further than that, I think was a huge mistake.
Now, the prosecution put on four straight witnesses who had been under 18 at the time of the incident, one who is now only 9 years old. The point was not only to provide witness testimony of the event, but also to elicit testimony that even these children knew that Floyd's life was in danger from the actions of Chauvin. In other words, this goes back to reasonableness. Even a child who we think of children as maybe not understanding as much of the world as a fully formed adult, even they knew on a basic level that this was not reasonable. Now, wisely, the defense asked very few questions of these witnesses after their blunder, really, with Frazier. And that's a tactic, too. Sometimes you have to know, you know, we see television shows about cross-examinations just completely demolishing a witness. Sometimes it's better for you to not ask any questions on cross because of the effect of swinging open a door that you don't want swung open.
Yeah, I think if the witness is crying on direct, you just don't ask any questions. I think it's always a bad idea to ask questions of a crying witness, but maybe that's just me. So after this, the prosecution calls one of the most fiery witnesses who's testified so far, Genevieve Hansen. And she is an EMT and Minneapolis firefighter who just so happened to be on scene, much like the gentleman earlier who had martial arts experience. This is a person who's a firefighter. This is a person who's an EMT. And this was really powerful testimony from a trained professional who, at the time, recognized signs that Floyd was in extreme distress. So remember, we started with the 911 operator. Then we did somebody at the scene, and we did the people who recorded the video. Now, this is another person who's on scene, but it's also somebody that traditionally you would think of as being a member of the police, right? EMT firefighter works hand in hand with the police, so this is someone who's more sort of closely aligned with the prosecution, much like that 911 operator. As she's watching this, she's becoming agitated, and she sees that Mr. Floyd is in extreme distress, and she does something really effective. She juxtaposes Mr. Floyd and what he's going through with Chauvin, and this is how she describes Chauvin. He seemed very comfortable with the majority of his weight balanced on top of Mr. Floyd's neck. In my memory, he had his hands in his pockets. He looked so comfortable. And this is something, if you've seen the video, a lot of people have commented on the fact that Chauvin does have his hands in his pockets, and it's like he's just hanging out. But to have her say that and to add sort of that, it's not just the video. I mean, everybody knows about video bias and the bias of sort of the camera. You only see what the camera sees, and so you don't see everything else. And there might be things going on around you that aren't in the camera's field that might change the way you're seeing things. Well, that's why it's good to have this person saying, no, what you're seeing in the cameras is exactly what was going on. And that's exactly what I saw as well. And she also becomes the third witness and the second sort of government witness. And government, I mean, the sort of closely aligned to the prosecution and the police, like the 911 operator, who called 911 on the police to report what she was seeing. And at some point, she actually walks over to the officers and offers to provide medical assistance to Mr. Floyd. And they told her if she were really a firefighter, she would know not to interfere. She said at first she tried to reason with the officers, and then she grew more and more angry, and she actually began to curse at the officers, which is something that the defense attempts to make hay of on cross-examination. Once again, they want to go to bias. They want to undermine this person's testimony. They want to say, look, this is an angry, hot-headed person, and so you can't really trust anything she said. And they're also trying to establish this notion of the crowd becoming more and more hostile, because they want the crowd to be an entity here as well that's causing the police officers distress and making them feel like we've really got to have control of the situation. We can't have, if Mr. Floyd gets up, who knows what might happen, that kind of thing. And so she's asked on cross-examination if she and the crowd were growing more hostile towards the officers. And she responded, "I don't know if you've seen anyone killed, but it's upsetting."
A very good response for the prosecution. I mean,
a very good response.
And again, because this is cross-examination, of course they've prepped her a lot, but they don't know how she's going to answer these questions. The prosecution doesn't. But that is, as you can probably assess for yourself, a very powerful statement for the prosecution.
So the defense has to object to the answer to its own question, which you never want to do. And the judge does strike this from the record. So it's like I always, you know, I like talking to my students about this. Okay, well, it's struck from the record. Now the jury will just forget about it. They never heard that, right? Like, that's how it works. Like, the jury is actually just going to, this will just disappear from what they've heard and won't have any effect on them.
And that's precisely why you have the motions in limine practice, motions in limine being before trial, about types of testimony that you never want to even be put out there, because we know that bells really actually can't be completely unrung. Even though the judge here strikes the response from the record, that's a powerful response that the jurors all heard.
And you'll even see that sometimes if a question's asked and you want to object to it, you need to object to it before the witness answers. Because a lot of times, if a question's asked and the witness answers and you jump up and object, the judge will just say, well, he's already answered. So, you know.
Because the, like, the judge recognizes that, you know, almost the damage has been done.
Right. It has to be something pretty significant, kind of like this, for the judge to actually take the step of striking it from the record. Well, it only gets worse from here. The conversation between Hansen and defense counsel continues to grow heated to the point that after the judge releases the jury for the day, he actually admonishes her and tells her not to argue with defense counsel, at which point she says, "I wasn't arguing. I was just finishing my question." At which point the court says, "And don't argue with the court either."
So, oh, ouch.
And it's funny. Like, this stuff, you always see these people, and if you've been following this, you saw experts on television talk about how this witness actually hurt the prosecution because she was so upset and combative, and so the jury's not going to believe her testimony. And I just don't buy that at all. I think when juries see passion, they tend to believe those people. I just don't believe this whole, you know, the jury is going to be so upset that she was angry and they won't believe what she said.
Yeah, and you know, it is so hard to read the jury. They're not supposed to, you're not supposed to have any communication. We'll take a quick aside here. Once a trial once a jury has been impaneled for a trial, there are strict rules. None of the attorneys are supposed to speak with any of the jurors. And it's one of those situations where if you see them in the hallway, you look down. You don't even go through the pleasantries of, "Hello, how is your day?" It's very strict because if there's any sort of misconduct, there could be declared a mistrial. And so obviously each person reacts in different ways, and the jurors cannot speak in the courtroom typically. Usually, they, you know, even when it comes to bathroom breaks, it's going to be the jurors telling the security officer to ask the judge, you know, if there can be a recess. The witnesses can speak, the attorneys can speak in turn, but the jurors don't speak. And so it really is a tough game to try and assess what's happening in someone's mind by looking at their faces. And you, as the attorney, you're usually focused on your witnesses. You want to look at the jurors and see how they're taking things in. And some people show their emotions on their face, but again, those are nonverbal cues, and you don't know those people individually. You don't know how they normally act or what their faces show when they're thinking. All to say that you're right. Maybe some people will find the passion very compelling, even if it comes off combative. And then some people may find it too combative, and they want someone more even-keeled to deliver a heated message. But I think you're right, Brett. Generally, I have found that passion, in whatever form it takes on the stand, becomes at least a witness that sticks in jurors' mind after the fact. The prosecution also calls Christopher Martin. Martin was an employee at the Cup Food Store where Floyd passed the counterfeit $20 bill. He laid the foundation for playing the surveillance video from the food store, which showed Floyd casually walking into the store. Martin testified that Floyd appeared to be under the influence of something when he was in his presence. Martin could tell by looking at the bill that it was counterfeit. Interestingly, he testified that Cup's Food Store took counterfeit money out of its employee's check, which is illegal in Minnesota and which Cup's denied. Martin eventually recorded the encounter with police, but when he realized Floyd died, he deleted it. Video showed Martin at the scene in disbelief, holding his head in his hands. Martin testified that if he just not reported the bill, none of this would have happened. Now, legal experts noted that passing a fake $20 bill is a misdemeanor in Minnesota, for which Floyd could have simply been given a citation.
And this is more powerful evidence. I mean, it's interesting because there's a couple things going on here. Number one, no one had ever seen this video before. This video, this is the first time we've seen this video, the video from inside the store. And you could have just had Martin, you could have just put him on the stand solely to lay a foundation for this video, say, yes, that's from the store, yes, that's from the day, there's Mr. Floyd, and then play the video for the jury and have this guy go. But this testimony about how he called the police because that's what he was supposed to do and how upset he was about that fact and how he blames himself for what happened. And if he just had acted differently, Mr. Floyd would still be alive. This is a theme you're seeing, right? So the gentleman with the martial arts expertise, the firefighter, the young girl even who took the video, all said things along this line that they wish they had done more. They wish they had done something different. If only they had done this or only they had done that. And you have them, and then you have Chauvin, who's the police officer, who is the person who actually could have done something different, who if he had changed his behavior, this wouldn't have happened. That juxtaposition, it's never going to be something that the prosecution expresses. I mean, maybe they will in closing argument, but I doubt it. I think this is one of those things that's better left unsaid, and the jury will think about that. What about him? How does he feel? Is he sorry for what he did? You know, does he stay up at night apologizing to Mr. Floyd? Did he have his head in his hands after this? And he didn't. And we know that because after this testimony, the prosecution moves to body cams. Now, as most of you know, these days, police officers all wear body cams, not all, but a lot of them do. And the Minnesota Police Department has body cams. And prosecution, they called a witness solely for the purpose of laying the foundation for the body cams. Boring testimony generally, but just to get the body cams in. And then they play them. And these are the body cameras for the officers who were on the scene and for Chauvin. And so you see, they arrive on the scene and the officers approach the car where Mr. Floyd was waiting. After Floyd opens the door, one of the officers actually draws his gun and Floyd begs him not to shoot him, which is another powerful moment in this, which we didn't really know about before this. The officer says he won't shoot him if he gets out of the car and shows his hands. Floyd can be heard saying he didn't know again and again, presumably that he did not know this was a fake $20 bill. Floyd is cuffed, and the officer asks if he is on anything. Another officer's body cam footage shows Chauvin with his knee on Floyd's neck, while another shows previous witnesses who we've already seen, you know, these witnesses who've already testified, who we recognize now, we now see them on body cam, and we see them begging the police to just let him up, begging the police to let them provide medical assistance. And we see them becoming more and more agitated and more concerned for Mr. Floyd. The body cam also shows that Floyd, he didn't want to enter the police car because he said he was claustrophobic, and he also said that he recently had the coronavirus. I actually don't know if that's true or not, but that is one of the things he said. And it's at this point when there's sort of a struggle. It's not a major struggle, but it is a struggle. And they are trying to get him into the police car, and Mr. Floyd is resisting. He doesn't want to go in the police car. And that's the point where the police take him to the ground while telling him to stop resisting. And you can hear conversations between the police officers talking about whether or not he's on something or not. And you can hear Mr. Floyd saying that he can't breathe. Now, this footage has its advantages for both sides. The defense will argue, and they've already laid the foundation for this argument in their opening statement, that Floyd was resisting. He refused to get into the police car. He was on something, or the police believe that. You can hear the police discussing it. So that is what they think is going on. The prosecution, however, is going to question whether the use of force that you're seeing in the video matches the facts, whether or not the force applied matches the resistance. Even if Floyd wasn't perfectly compliant, were the actions of the officers in response reasonable?
Right. So you can see a lot of questions, and you start to get into witnesses where you don't know how the jury is going to interpret it. And the defense tries to make their argument through these cross-examinations. Let's talk about Floyd's girlfriend. The prosecution calls Courtney Ross, and she testified how she met Floyd at a Salvation Army shelter where he worked as a security guard and where her son was staying. She had become upset when her son wouldn't come down to see her, at which point Floyd approached her and asked if he could pray with her. She testified how Floyd had greatly changed after the death of his mother and how they had both become addicted to opioids due to pain in their neck and back. They would often buy opioids on the black market. By the way, this is a great example of the prosecution taking the sting out of bad information. So we've already, it's kind of been in the background of the officers' body cam showing them talking about whether Floyd is on something, with the food store owner wondering if maybe he was on some substance. And now the prosecution is addressing it head on, that this witness, as well as Floyd, were addicted to opioids. That could be a zinger on cross-examination if you didn't know this ahead of time. But they're taking the sting out of any potential cross-examination question by bringing it to light first, so that later on there's no zinger. We already told you that they were addicted to opioids, and it was due to real pain.
And they do it in such a interesting way, right? Like, putting the girlfriend on the stand at this stage, ordinarily, you probably wouldn't even be able to do that, because victim impact type statements are for sentencing, not for trial. You know, if you have the victim talking about how much they've suffered and how much they miss their loved one, that's really going to inflame the jury and make the jury possibly make a decision about guilt or innocence that has nothing to do with the facts, has nothing to do with whether or not the accused actually did anything. But here, the whole point is to address this notion of whether or not George Floyd was on drugs at the time. And they do it by introducing the girlfriend and telling the story about how they met, where Floyd, and you've all seen this. I mean, you've all seen this if you follow this case online. There are people who will say things like, Floyd was a drug addict. Floyd was a criminal. What were the police supposed to do? You know, if he didn't want this to happen, he should have complied, or he shouldn't have been on drugs, or whatever. You've all seen that, right? Well, the prosecution is doing two things here. Number one, they're establishing that Floyd was a security guard at the Salvation Army, for goodness sake. And he sees this woman in distress, and he goes over and asks if she wants to pray with him about what's going on in her life, and they begin a relationship. And they explain, yes, okay, he was on drugs, but like so many people out there, it was one of those things that came from pain and an addiction that grew over time.
Brett, let me interject for a moment, because up until the mention about addiction, remember earlier you had mentioned that all questions have to be relevant to the charges brought. Up until that point, you can see how there could be an objection to relevance. How is it relevant that he was a security guard? How is it relevant that he offered to pray with a woman in distress? But these are all great points for the prosecution to be able to essentially kind of sneak in with the angle of, we're talking about the potential for drug use at this time.
And this is one of those really gray areas of the law. There are one of the great sort of, if you go to law school, those of you who are going to law school, you're going to take criminal law, and you're going to have some professor who's going to give you a hypothetical that there's a murder, and the defendant is willing to stipulate that the person was stabbed to death, and the prosecution wants to show photographs, 100 photographs of this person stabbed to death and blood all over the place. And the defense objects and says, Your Honor, we've stipulated the fact that they're dead. We've stipulated the fact that they're stabbed to death. These photographs are not relevant anymore. There's no relevance. They don't prove anything. All they do is inflame the jury. And the judge is going to say, well, sorry, it comes in because that's what we've decided. The prosecution gets to tell its story, and it gets to tell it in this sort of storytelling way. It's not, as we said before, just sort of a scientific thing. So in the telling of the story of how they met, the prosecution is able to layer in all this information about where he was when they met and their first encounter. And like Alice said, sort of sneak in this stuff that makes Floyd a more attractive victim. And not to say that he's not attractive, but the defense is putting Floyd on trial as much as anything. They are trying to say Floyd was a dangerous man acting dangerously, and the police had to do what they had to do. And this is a great way to not only take the sting out of the fact that he was on drugs, but also to humanize him beyond that 9 minutes and 29 seconds.
Right. And now the defense asked questions about their drug addiction and where they got the drugs. In fact, it was from a man who was with Floyd and in the passenger seat of the car when he was approached by police. And his name was Maurice Hall. Now, Hall will not testify as he has invoked his Fifth Amendment rights. And that actually will be a whole nother discussion in a future episode about his invocation of the Fifth Amendment rights. We'll get to that later. And for those of you, quickly, the Fifth Amendment allows you to abstain from answering any questions that can incriminate yourself. So typically, you have to answer all questions truthfully. And unless there's a privilege that you can claim, like marital privilege, clergy privilege, if you confess a sin to your priest, for example, counselor privileges, there's different types of privileges, attorney-client privilege. If it doesn't fall under a category of a privilege, you have to answer the question truthfully, unless it incriminates yourself, in which case you can invoke the Fifth. So now you guys probably have heard the term a lot. I invoke the Fifth. I invoke the Fifth Amendment. That's what it means. You don't have to testify against yourself. Now, the cashier testified that Hall had attempted to pass a fake 20 at the cops earlier in the day. So we're getting some information about Hall, even though Hall will not testify. Now, after Courtney Ross's testimony, the paramedics who responded to the scene testified that upon their arrival, Floyd's heart was not beating and they thought he was dead.
And that's a nice piece of information because, as we're going to learn later, one of the duties of the police officers is to render medical assistance until the paramedics arrive. And in this case, that didn't happen. And by the time the paramedics got there, Mr. Floyd was essentially dead. He would not be declared dead until he arrived at the hospital, but it seems as though he was pretty much dead by the time the paramedics arrived. Okay, so we started with the 911 operator. Then we went to the emotion of the scene, and we interspersed that with some people who have some connections to the police department. Now we're going to shift very heavily towards the police department, and this is where we're going to be for a while. The prosecution next calls Derek Chauvin's supervisor, David Plager. Now, Plager testified that it is the policy of the department to roll a suspect onto their side while restraining them so as to ensure they are not deprived of oxygen. Recall, the defense, their entire argument and their entire position and their entire case is built on the notion that Chauvin was operating under department procedures. And that whatever happened, if it was the fault of anybody, it was the procedures, and he was just being a reasonable cop, and this is a tragedy that resulted from the use of force, but it's not a crime. This is the beginning of the prosecution's effort to show that, no, the police are on our side, and they're going to tell you that what he was doing had nothing to do with department policy. Now, this is particularly important because the reason for these policies is specifically because of a concern that if the policies aren't followed, the suspect might have a deprivation of oxygen, which is exactly what we have here. This is important for the prosecution because it makes it much more difficult for the defense to argue that Derek Chauvin wouldn't have known that what he was doing ran the risk of depriving Mr. Floyd of oxygen. And in fact, Mr. Plager testified that it is a policy to roll someone over even when officers are not putting weight on the person, which obviously is the opposite of what we had here. And Plager testified that once Floyd was on the ground and handcuffed, the use of restraint should have ended. And you are going to see that again and again and again in this case. I think it's interesting. I think it says something about what the prosecution's actually, what they're actually trying to do here. I don't really think they are going for second degree murder. I think they really are going for either the third degree murder or the manslaughter. And this testimony makes me think even more so that that's the case. And the reason I say that, no one who testifies, at least so far that I've seen from the prosecution, is going to say that what the police did in the beginning was unreasonable. They are going to say that at some point they should have stopped, that at some point department policies would have told them to stop. And this sort of violation of department policy that leads to death, to me, seems much more like one of those lesser included offenses than the most severe offense that we have here. And I haven't really seen anything by the prosecution where they're trying to reach that highest level. And I'll be interested to see if we see that down the line. So with this witness, the prosecution asked the question, based upon your review of this incident, do you believe that the restraint should have ended at some point in the encounter? Now, this resulted in an objection from the defense and a conversation outside the presence of the jury. And the defense, this is the sort of boring thing that happens, but I wanted to highlight it just so you know what's kind of going on when you have these sidebars. The defense had argued that this individual had not reviewed all of the evidence in the case, and therefore he could not give a full opinion on whether or not he should have ended his restraint at some point. The defense objection is sustained, and the prosecution asked a more narrow question. And I'll let you decide whether or not this sort of esoteric difference matters. Do you have an opinion as to when the restraint of Mr. Floyd should have ended in this encounter? So that's a perfectly fine question. And the response is, when Mr. Floyd was no longer offering up any resistance to the officers, they could have ended their restraint. Prosecution question, and that was after he was handcuffed and on the ground and no longer resisting? Correct. So this is a very difficult thing for Chauvin and his defense to overcome. Even if you believe that initially their actions were justified, and frankly, most of the prosecution witnesses say they were, the fact that after Mr. Floyd is in handcuffs and on the ground, that this restraint technique, whatever you want to call it, was not ended is a huge problem and is very difficult to explain.
Yeah, so just a note on practicing on your feet in the courtroom. If an objection is sustained, what the prosecution did in this case and what you tried to do is to ask the question in a different way that will not draw an objection. And ultimately, the prosecution was able to get the answer out that it was seeking with its original question that was objected to. And it does take some skill to know how to do that in a way that doesn't continue to draw objections. Following another foundation witness, the prosecution called Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, the highest ranking officer in the Minneapolis Police Department. First, Zimmerman described the continuum of force an officer uses. He said, for instance, when you arrive at a scene, no matter what the scene, the first level, the lowest level, would be just your presence at a scene, in uniform. The next step up, maybe your verbal skills that you've learned to help diffuse a situation or learn information about whatever the situation is. The next step would be a soft technique, escorting the person by their arm, that type of thing. The next level would be a hard technique, That's where you would use your, you maybe have to use your mace or handcuffs, that kind of thing. And finally, the top level on the continuum is deadly force. This is important information for the prosecution to get out because they, again, have aligned themselves with the police. So they have to show that, of course, there are steps that a police officer needs to use within their toolbox to take control of a situation. But the layperson may not actually know what that continuum looks like. Once it's laid out on a spectrum like that, you begin to see the story that you begin to see the spectrum that the prosecution kind of laid out and drew a picture of in their opening statement. And what they're trying to say is that this is a normal continuum. And what Chauvin did is not even on this continuum because it's unreasonable. Now, Zimmerman stated that he had never trained an officer to put his knee on someone's neck while they are in handcuffs. He characterized this action as the use of, quote, deadly force. He stated that when someone is in handcuffs, the use of deadly force is not appropriate. He was adamant that when someone has been handcuffed, their ability to harm an officer or a bystander is basically nil. He also testified that every officer knows that once someone is in handcuffs, they need to be moved out of the prone position so that they can breathe. Now, on cross, the defense attempted to make things a little less black and white than what Zimmerman testified to. They tried to do this by asking whether officers are able to improvise use of force if they are under threat. Zimmerman agreed that that would be appropriate in certain circumstances, which set up the prosecution on redirect to ask if, based on the body cam footage, those circumstances were met. Zimmerman responded very succinctly with one word, no.
They ended the first week with Zimmerman, prosecution did, and Zimmerman is a really crushing witness. I mean, he does a lot of damage to the defense. And I think it is certainly the case, coming out of week one, the prosecution is way ahead. And they have managed to marry the emotion of that day and the video with some really what should be dry and basic testimony about the policy of the department and all these different levels of force and, you know, all this stuff. But when married to the emotion of that video, becomes really interesting and really riveting testimony almost, with this officer saying, this is just not appropriate, and just really crushing the defense's entire strategy. I mean, the defense told you, this is the problem with opening statements. Whatever you say in opening statements is going to be hung around your neck in closing arguments. And the defense said, we're going to show that what he did was consistent with the policies of the police department. And here you have these high-ranking police officials come in and without equivocation say, no, it wasn't. This was completely inappropriate. And there's a lot of ground to make up for the defense. To give you a hint, we're recording this during week two. I feel like the defense is doing much better in week two. But this first week is bad and maybe unrecoverable. It may be the case, frankly, that once the jury hears this testimony, the two combined things of what happened that day and what they're hearing from these officers, that there's no coming back for the defense, that they will have decided that Chauvin is guilty of something. One of those things, not sure which, but he's guilty of something. So there's a lot of trial left, though. I mean, there's a lot of witnesses left. The defense is just asking questions. They haven't even begun to put on their witnesses yet or the story they're going to tell. So there's still a lot to say, but up to this point, I think the prosecution has really done a fabulous job of presenting their case.
Well, we've covered a lot in these two episodes, and we've also left out a lot. But we try to summarize kind of the main witnesses for you so you can have an idea of what the jury is hearing from the prosecution. And we'll continue to try to give you coverage of the trial in a way that presents the facts as they are being presented within court.
Yeah, and I know you guys already have thoughts and comments and questions. Hit us up with those at prosecutorspod@gmail.com, at prosecutorspod for all of your social media. We are recording these as the trial goes on. So these are actually a little bit more stressful because we're recording them and then we got to edit them and get them out the next week. So if you email us, we will answer your questions almost in real time. So let us know if you have questions or thoughts about everything that's going on in this trial. We always look forward to hearing from you guys. Thank you for your continued support. Thank you for continuing to tell your friends and family about our podcast. One bit of excitement is we will be attending CrimeCon in Austin the first week in June. So if you were thinking about whether or not you wanted to attend CrimeCon and we can push you in the direction of doing so, we would love to see all you guys. We don't want to be sitting there alone with no one to talk to while all the other podcasts get all the love. So please consider going to CrimeCon. And if you do, if you enter promo code prosecutors, you will get 10% off any ticket. So come see us in Texas.
Yes, come join us. My childhood hometown.
There you go. Alice can show us the town. Show us all the good places to eat and drink. It'll be great. All right, guys. Well, it's been a fun week. We will be back next week with more on this trial. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors.
Don't die on me. Now that would make today the most stressful day of all time.
Make today the worst.
Today was a really tough day at work, and Brett died.
And Brett died.